Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like, in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there, and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Hello, friends. This is Matt McDonald from The Classic Crime, and I want to let you know something. We are playing, my wife and I are playing acoustic songs on Saturday nights on Twitch for free. So we're doing The Classic Crime songs, we're doing Vocal Fuse songs, we're covering songs, sometimes we're freestyling randomly. Often we are drinking a beverage of our choice. You are welcome to have a beverage of your choice, any beverage. We sometimes burn sage, we toast, we laugh, we meme, we have fun. Saturday nights at 9 p.m. PST, it's called Quarantunes. So while we were in lockdown, we set this thing up where we started doing shows, and it kind of became a thing, and we went away for a while, and now we're coming back. So Quarantunes Season 2, Saturday nights, twitch.tv/theclassicmatt. That's twitch.tv/theclassicmatt. It's free. It's fun. Join us. It's going to be good. Saturday nights, 9 p.m. PST. See you there.
Another story also involves STDs burn. You remember we were riding down our bus and we had an asshole bus driver, Timmy. We told Astley's Burn, hey, there's something. We called you guys and we said, hey, there's something wrong with the back of the bus. We think our lights are out. Can you pull up right behind our bus while we're going down the highway, like, you know, 60, 70 miles an hour? You pull up right behind our bus and see if you can see it. And they were on the phone and they pulled up behind us. And then Timmy hit the lever and shot all of our piss onto their face. It opened right up and went complete. I mean, your van was just covered in it. And I think y'all said, hey, something just came out. you didn't know it was me. You thought something bad.
Something's wrong with the bus.
You were warning us, hey.
Yeah, huge
hey,
leak
something
back
bad's
here.
Happening to the bus. But literally, that was the thing that we did. And you know what's cool? Y'all didn't really get mad. I was really glad about that.
Yeah. We weren't little bitches.
Right.
We were all right.
Some people get super mad on tour.
I remember on Warped Tour, I don't know, I think it was like 2008 with you guys, where you guys would do like shaking buses. I don't know what you called it.
Rock the bus.
Rock the bus. Yeah, yeah. You go. You get like 10 people on the side of someone's bus, and you just start pushing together in unison, and the whole bus starts shaking, and then of course the band comes out or the tour manager comes out and everyone's pissed off.
Yeah,
but like,
you're not pissed off. I mean, think about it though for a second. You're on Warped Tour, sitting on your bus in the afternoon drinking with your friends.
Yeah,
all of a sudden you're around a bunch of buses, all of a sudden you feel a gentle motion that gradually increases, and you look around each other and go, this is weird. And you look outside and some friends of yours
are shaking your bus,
just moving your bus back and forth. Yeah. Now, would you be angry about that?
You shouldn't be angry. I remember some bands were angry because I went with you guys.
I know. That's why I can't understand though.
And some people were really pissed off. But I remember, like, I think we did Census Fails bus or something. They were cool. I think Buddy was cool.
It's just funny. But Silverstein was mad, but they came out like, "Who the fuck?" Oh, it's you guys. Oh, okay, it's fine. Yeah. They come out like, "What
it's
the fuck?"
That's because they're Canadian. They're like, they're trying to hockey fight you every time you do something.
That sounds about right. With Silverstein,
whatever. But you could, you know, the first reaction was, "What the fuck is somebody doing to us?" Is what is funny.
Yeah. Someone's
like Kobe and Matt, you know.
Right.
Well, the problem with that, nobody in that band is even funny at all. Like they don't, have a single funny person at all.
That's funny. That's funny.
So that's the reason. If you even had one funny person to calibrate the whole
group, that's what Logan said about our band, and he's probably right. But Logan, I mean, he tried to embarrass us on the bus once. Line check Logan used to check Emery's lines. Weird. But he's a loudmouth braggart is what he is. And he was like, well, you guys had like a VIP on your bus, and like me and Robbie walk on, and he's like, look at the Classic Crime. These guys aren't funny at all. These guys are the least funny band ever. And then we did some impression of Matt and made everyone laugh, and then went back to the back of the bus.
But now, Robbie and Skip are funny, but not in the
they
way
don't
that,
they don't intend to be funny. No,
they don't know. They don't
and
know.
I'm only funny when I'm drunk, so I'm not really, I can't claim to be that funny.
Robbie is one of my favorite people on earth, and y'all know that. He can do no when he shoots a video of himself, he can do no wrong in my eyes. I wish to God there was a Robbie reality show. Just Robbie. That's what it's called.
It's just his Facebook page.
That's true. But I mean, it's so great. He's just a wild man. It's just funny. And he's like one of the easiest people to be around. Like, you don't ever have to worry about keeping the conversation going or him not holding his half of the, he is going to talk as much as anybody.
Yeah. He won't, it won't be awkward with him.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he won't never shut up, but yeah.
But he's always, like, he is always present with you when you're talking to him. He's not,
yeah, that's
he's
right.
not thinking about something else. He just never is. That, yeah. Like, it's when you talk to him, you're like, oh, this is happening now. It's like a good feeling.
Right. He's very present.
He needs attention, and he will sit there and take up all of your time for sure. Yeah. I mean, he'll call me and just sit there and just bullshit for like 2 hours in the middle of the day. I'm like, dude, don't you work? But yeah, he's good. He's a good hang that way.
Well, I liked tour managing him was very fun and easy. He was very easy to tour manage.
Yeah.
Because he was always very happy, and sure. You could just do very little. If you did anything for him at all, like get him a beer to bring it on stage, he just thought, wow, that guy just put in the whole day's work for sure right now.
Right. Yeah, he loves it. And he likes laughing at other people's suffering, which is a good sense of humor. Like if someone trips and falls, he'll just die. He'll just die laughing. So that's a good sense of humor. I wouldn't say he's funny that way, but he has a sense. He has a sense.
Lunsford, were you the funny guy in Assy's Burn?
You have to be.
No, not really. Well, you said we didn't get mad about the piss thing.
Yeah.
Assy's Burn, as far as like me, Cody, TJ, and Colin, I think we all, even Cody, who is the way he is, Cody can be very, very funny if you catch him on the right wavelength, right? And so TJ in that setting is definitely our funniest guy. TJ is one of the funniest people ever as far as just in a friend setting, the stuff he might do to make you laugh.
Right.
But I was probably obnoxiously funny, but not, I think I've gotten funnier as I've gotten older. As more bad stuff has happened to me, I've just gotten funnier.
That's how it works, right?
Yeah. So nobody else in our band could have ever done stand up or anything like that. But that's a different funny thing, I think. So.
Yeah.
Well, when we first started hanging out with you, you were a total asshole bitch because you were married to your first wife.
Oh no,
that's true. You were married to your first wife.
Who stays married to their first wife?
And that one just did not go over good. That just you were so nervous or thin. Remember how skinny you were?
I know. Y'all liked me the first time we went on tour before I was with the one right before Tim died. That was a good time. But then later when we shared a bus, I was wearing white leather shoes and shit and vest.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, long pointy shoes. Cool.
Y'all did not like me.
I
didn't
know that.
I was unaware. I didn't know. So
white chose wrong.
Yeah, that was when, I mean, but it wasn't just us. Like, your band also agreed that was douche.
Yeah. Right.
That was your douche phase. It was pretty brief. I'll give you that.
Yeah. Well, I think there's something to be said that I came out on the other side, and also that people kept me around and gave me a chance to, you know, they saw what was happening. I was being, you know, it was like Saving Silverman. It wasn't like
that fame went to your head.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody's hoping to save me somehow. But then when that marriage ended and I came out to tour manage y'all for the first time on the Under Oath AVR tour, I was like immediately cool again. Like you immediately liked me again. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Cause you went through the shit. That's a Emery standard with coming on tour with us. You had to go through some ideal shit. I mean, that seems like every single person did that.
Yeah, we tend to really interface well with people at rock bottom.
Right. We just,
that's when they're like,
pick them up. Oh,
yeah, I mean, that's really a big, really mega theme in our history is very much that.
That's why I'm here now. Y'all kept me around for 10 years.
It's just something about people at rock bottom that is, I mean, I don't know. It's not really intentional, but it's just
honest.
It's just like they're all, I mean, it's like, I don't know. It's just, it's good.
Lunsford is perpetual rock bottom. So we keep getting, I know. He's never going to leave. Something's always, you are literally.
He can't wait to graduate. I remember on the text thread, he's always like, fuck you guys. I'm out. I finally got the job. I'm rich now. We can't be friends. A week later, he's back. Lost the job. Rock bottom.
All right. Yesterday, I saw my old company, Eventbrite. They're hiring again. For my old job, all right.
You're not still furloughed, I don't guess.
No. They laid off everybody. But yesterday, I went on the website because I'm curious when that industry is going to start coming back. They are hiring like crazy because they're anticipating what's going to happen going forward, and they're building a sales team again. And my old job was listed, and I was like, "Oh, holy shit! Maybe I'll apply. Maybe I can get it back." Right? They hired me once.
Yeah. Right.
I applied. I messaged my old manager. 3 hours later, I got a generic HR email saying, we don't feel like you're the right fit for this position at this time.
It was your job. Man. You didn't get fired from it.
Laid off with 400 other people, right? And now they're hiring it again. Entry-level job. It took 3 hours to get a generic HR email back.
That quit. Like, they were so happy. They did not know. How long did you work there? You said your old company.
5 weeks. 4 weeks.
5 weeks. Your old company in 5 weeks. And in those 5 weeks, they were like, dear God, how do we get rid of him? What do we do? Lord, we'll take anything.
God, this pandemic happened.
Yeah, the pandemic is like, oh, thank you. What a blessing in disguise.
We anoint thee, Father. You are worthy of our praise.
Cassie said, what if they staged the whole layoff just to get rid of me?
Cassie's onto something there.
Everybody still works there. They changed their LinkedIns, like they moved on to other companies.
Like, you would have had a much better chance at getting the job had you applied now and never previously worked there.
That is crazy that he sent you a letter immediately. It was like, no way. That was your actual boss? That you wrote?
I messaged my boss like, hey, I'm reapplying for this job. I'd love to come, I'd love to come back. Like, it'd be good. I liked the job when I had it. It paid pretty good. Something to do. And I got a generic, within 5 minutes of him approving my connection on LinkedIn, because we weren't connected, 5 minutes later, the HR email came back. Thank you for applying. We thoroughly reviewed your application. While we're very impressed with your history, we do not feel like this position's the right fit for you at this time. They already hired me for it once. So what does that say about them? Like, I was a good fit before.
It says they learned from their mistakes. So what do you mean?
Yeah, fool me once. Well,
I guess so.
I mean, you got the job with your skill level last time. The only thing you did was add to your skill of actually working there. Like, you actually you learned a skill about working there, and then they said no. So, I mean, they just didn't like you, right? That has to be it's not your skills. They didn't like you as a person.
You're certainly qualified. Right? It's just you.
I mean, it couldn't be that you had worse skills than when they hired you the first time. So it literally, he does not like you.
Yeah, maybe not. Yeah, I was a little bit relieved, to be honest, but
that's true. I mean, you did apply for a job, you did the best you could. I mean,
exactly. Yeah. So I just focused on my food blog.
Did y'all see Texas and Mississippi are full capacity, no masks at all?
Praise the Lord.
What's going to happen with that, though? Like, I mean, is it just going down so fast that they're going to look? Is it either or? Will they look horrific and all these people are going to die, or nothing's going to happen and it'll be totally fine?
Both will happen at the same time, of course, depending on who you ask.
Yeah, that's true.
100% both of those fully will happen.
Yeah.
There is no anything that anybody could do to actually know anything.
Right.
That's not possible. And now, even if you said in advance, okay, let's please agree. So, I mean, because I'm sure that it will have effects. I mean, it's basically going to be a third wave, basically.
Yeah.
And they're just betting, and they're trying to ride the political line and betting that they can, you know, skirt that without looking bad enough and then win a bunch of political favor. And they're willing to trade some lives for it. That's the political calculus.
Shit. That's cold.
And then, of course, somebody was going to do that, but it is, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, it's a political decision, and it, you know, it'll cost lives, but that's part of the calculus, just like the freaking the speed limits. I mean, we live in that world. People just don't want to admit it. It will it look bad or not, but in the current state, it's just nobody will even agree that to that there could be a way to measure it. Do you remember a year ago? It was like, okay, there's going to be stat. Like, you thought some stat would emerge that you'd see on the news every night or something that would really... You better compare apples to apples eventually, and it just got farther and farther away. And now they say, even if there is an uptick, everybody will say, yeah, because they don't test or whatever.
Yeah.
So it won't even be – somebody like me is begging for somebody to say, well, just make a prediction and we'll see which happens. But nobody will, and even if they did, they wouldn't go back to it. Or
it wouldn't matter.
There's just no way anybody will quantify anything or stand by it, and they'll always deny it. So everybody, both parties will get what they want. And see the reality that they want to see, I guess.
I've only seen, I mean, I check my Facebook feed, and the way people post about it or think about it is very strange to me. Like, they'll say something like, well, Texas better get their body bags ready. Or, wow, this is, you know, everybody just wants to die in Texas. But that's not true at all. Like, definitely not everybody's going to die, right? And, like, some people will die, but which people that choose to just go out and do whatever. Isn't it weird, like, people think the worst thing possible can happen? Like, 1 million people are going to die in Texas now or something. But I don't think that's possible. I don't think that will happen.
Well, I mean, some will, and then we won't know how many.
That'll be the thing. It won't be like people, no matter what, if one person dies from it, you'll be able to say, see, somebody died from it.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's basically a zero tolerance on one side. But, everybody... behaves as if, oh, we have a zero tolerance for X, Y, or Z, but it's not. That's not true. But there's no way to discuss, or it's just we're unwilling to actually. It's all in bad faith. I mean, there's nothing to really discuss about.
Well, the thing Lunzer's saying too that is true is, you don't, like, a mandatory lockdown means everybody's at home. When they lift that, you can still mandatory lockdown yourself.
Yes.
Right. I mean, you basically can't. I mean, you can go to the grocery stores will have more people at them, but you could go at off times maybe. I mean, you could still do that yourself. So I wonder, I mean, in some sense, we're talking about the people of Texas or Mississippi want this. And so did they get
some
a say
or
do you say they're so stupid they can't even understand themselves? Like, they don't understand the danger themselves and you have to help them, like that, you know, babysitter.
Well,
mentality.
That's guys, I'm back. I'm sorry. I got cut out for a second there. The ladies were cleaning the office and knocked the Wi-Fi out. So if you were asking where I went, that's where I went. Nowheresville. But I was going to say there is a level of, like, safetyism that Texas doesn't necessarily fall in line with, which is to say that if a minority of people are at risk, the majority should change their behavior so that the minority can be safe, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in other places in the country, it's less of that. It's more like, okay, if a minority people are at risk, they should stay home and the majority should go about their business. You know what I'm saying? And I think there's value, or that's it's a valid opinion, I think, you know. It's not necessarily evil or bad to say, okay, if you're at risk, take extra precaution, but if you're not,
yeah, well, you go could back have to, go a back situation
to your
life.
Well, hold on. Two things there real quick. Sorry, Matt, to interrupt you. One is, I forget. The other one is, that's the most I've ever heard a white man say the ladies who clean and then say the word minority over and over and over again. Did y'all hear that? Rewind the tape. My God. He started talking about minorities.
Minorities.
What are you saying?
At the cleaning lady.
I mean, if you just barely edited
now
that.
Now he's rambling on about Texas minorities.
This is
got weird.
The Kickstarter money goes to cleaning ladies.
The ladies who are cleaning are the basic the landowners here. They're not Mexican cleaning ladies. They're white.
I didn't even say that. No one said that.
Yeah, but good.
Oh
Lord.
My God! I said ladies. About? Oh my Lord!
Well, that's a stereotype, but yeah, that's not true in this case.
I hear you.
I pay my rent to these ladies.
The other thing I was going to say is, I would be a little bit intimidated to go play in those places, though. I guess the clubs will be open, but I mean, would you really want to go play a packed room in
Texas
right now?
You just get vaccinated. You just get vaccinated and go. Who cares?
Yeah, I guess.
Isn't that the
I guess
point? You would make that choice. Toby would decide if he wants to do that. And
I think
then the
I would say
are...
no to a. Okay. I mean, to a 300 cap, 500 cap room, and it's mostly full. Yeah. I'd be like, oh, this seems
once
a,
I'm
this
vaccinated, I don't care. I honestly don't care. Like, yeah. I'm not spreading it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, once you can't spread it to other people.
But the technicality there is interesting because you could, you know, in theory, you could have behavior that was really responsible where there was, I'd point it out is you could have very responsible behavior in theory without a government guideline by a population. And you could also have strict government regulations and very poor behavior, such as I believe that's a lot of what the difference in California is. Like they have a lot of regulations and people still act poorly anyway. So you could have the inverse of that where the governor's not telling you what to do and you stay the fuck home.
Yeah.
And prove that you don't need a babysitter by being responsible enough when you're 8. Maybe the mom and dad will leave you alone a little bit. So that would be nice if that was people's motivation. Is watch Texas whip California's ass on numbers with no regulations.
Well,
would be the mentality I wish they would have.
It's the living situations, the context in which the virus it finds itself in. When it finds itself in a lot of multi-family residential homes in California, or you know where people are living in close proximity to each other, whereas in Texas. You know, everyone's got a ranch, you know, it's like a $40,000 ranch. You know, like, you know, it's different. You can't, it's not the same as like New York. They have subways. Everyone gets inside a tube and shares the air, you know, of course it's going to be bad in New York. So Texas will probably be fine regardless, I think, just because of it's so spread out.
Well, they seem generally prepared to accept what they're doing. I mean,
whatever it is.
I think it'll be fine in that sense, but you know, some people won't be thrilled.
It's hilarious. I mean, my kids still go to 2.5 to 3 hours of school a day, and you know, still Zoom one day, and then 4 days they go like 3 hours. And I'm like, the rest. I mean, it seems like everybody goes to school except for exactly my town. It's weird. all the towns around me go to school all day, but I mean, it's just like I'm like I don't understand this. Like, we can at least send the kids back. Let's get the kids a little bit more normalcy. I mean, my kids are really want to be around more kids, and it's
Biden came out and said we got to get the kids back to school, get all the teachers vaccinated. Like he's all, you know, all on board with it now. But yeah,
it's been pretty bad. There's been like 47 kids between the ages of 0 and 18 die of COVID
in the world or
in America.
Oh, okay.
Times two the flu though, I think so.
Oof. Okay.
It's interesting. I don't know if I said this on the podcast or not, but there's a buddy of mine that works at a school, and he said that transmission between the kids really just isn't happening. Like, now there will be a parent or an adult in the kid's life that has it, and the kid might could get it from them, but almost always there's never
kid.
If somebody has it, so with tracing, I guess, or they say, hey, some Billy's dad has it or whatever, so the whole class has to go back to Zoom for that week, but everybody else, all the other classes keep going, and there just hasn't been outbreaks that they've really seen. Not to say that there aren't those, but I'm just saying it seems a lot less for kids. It's crazy. That's my point here. It's wild how this didn't affect kids much.
Since day one they are making the biggest sacrifice out of any portion of the populace, and they are the least at risk of this disease.
Yeah, right.
They're the least at risk to spread it and to get it and to die from it. So like, and they're making the greatest sacrifice. Like, imagine you're a kid and you lose a year and a half of your development, social development at an age where that equates to a third of your, you know, schooling career. You know, it's like just it's a huge chunk that they'll never get back. And I've been saying this from the beginning, and then all the scientists said it as well. Like you said, they do it with contact tracing. A bunch of PhDs at, you know, Harvard and Yale, Yale and Oxford are writing things like, send the kids back to school. It's way better for them to be in school right now. And they're super low risk. So
I know that's the most bizarre thing too, because you have to, if you don't agree with that, we got to send the kids back. And I've been thinking that for a long time, for a very long time, but, I can even, at least now you have to sweep under the rug the abuse and bad stuff that's happening to kids. Like you said, right. I mean, they really are making the worst. I mean, not only are they missing that, I was thinking about it. What if I missed my whole fourth grade year?
Right.
It was just at my house. That really did do stuff.
I mean,
and then
what if you were trapped inside with your abusive or neglectful parents
in the worst stressful conditions of their whole life? Think about it you guys this year. Overall, you know, the time when you have little children is the most stressful, difficult time of your life, and it's COVID. So, by all estimations, which is, I think there's a bright side here, this is probably the worst time of your life.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? This is probably the, I mean, it could get a lot worse for a lot of reasons, especially individually. But you know what I mean? Like, if you are a young parent of young kids, this might be the worst overall of your life. This is predictably the worst time of your life.
Do you guys feel that? 100%. Do you feel that this has been the worst time of your life? Do you feel that?
Well, I mean, no, not me personally, but I mean, everybody, that's like saying my wife's smoking hot or something. So I don't want to really make that argument. I'm trying to think of, maybe it is the most stress. Maybe this is the worst time of my life. Like, I'm having to be like stronger and more responsible than I've had to be. I kind of like it though, or is the way I would say it. But a previous version of me would say, what this guy right here, that Matt Carter, is living a fucking shitty ass life right now. Like, maybe a 25-year-old version of me would have really seen my experience now as a hellish thing.
Yes.
I think if I would have gotten COVID real early, like, you know, I don't want me or my family to die. But if I knew it would just be sickness, I know you don't know that, this is all hypothetical, but I would have loved if I'd have gotten it in January. I think I probably would have enjoyed, I would have traveled. I would have, you know, I would have gone and saw places with no lines. You know what I mean? All that stuff. I would have done as much stuff as I could. I would have gotten outside even more in the beginning. I mean, we were scared to even, you know, I would cross the street every time for a long time, just if I went for a jog or something like that. But man, if I would have gotten it really early, I think I would have felt mentally way better in 2020 if I'd have just gotten it and gotten over it.
I don't understand, because that behavior made sense at first for, you know, to cross the street when people are jogging to be scared. But there's so much information now. I don't, what is the willful ignorance that people, like, I bet if you polled people, I think people think thousands of kids have died. And it's not. It's like 40 kids from the ages 0 to like 7. It's like 40. Like,
but
it's virtually.
But you can't
none.
Even get past that, though. I mean, people say, I mean, as soon as you say 47, people go, 47, Aaron. How many? I mean, that's a lot. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the issue. So they can't even get past any. So,
I know, but if that's the logic, then they should never go to school again, because I'm not trying to be the coronavirus is the flu guy, but that's literally not as bad as the flu.
Well,
the flu is more dangerous to your kids than coronavirus has
year
been.
Year in and year out, Yeah,
I don't understand where's the cognitive dissonance there.
Well, they probably won't go back. I think a lot of people won't go back. I'm really wondering what school is actually going to look like headed towards the future. Because
my kids just went back this week for 2 days a week, and they're doing 2 days remote and then 2 days in the classroom. And my third grade daughter went back to a classroom of 7 other people than her, so 8 total people.
Wow. Yeah, same
so
as
that means,
us.
That means like 14, 15 of her classmates' parents opted to keep them at home. So I don't know if it's because they're afraid of, or they've gotten to a rhythm, and and the buses aren't going, so they have to drop them off and pick them up. Yeah, maybe that's a problem.
Totally.
But not a lot of people are opting in to go back.
That's going to be so fascinating. I mean, I think it's really, really opened up the people's minds in a way that's at least positive, because I mean it's really negative, of course, for most situations, but it has to change people's mindsets about wanting to go back and what other things could work. I mean, I'm a big fan of the idea of decentralized school. Whatever that could mean would have to be good. I mean, I wish Georgia didn't have to go back next year. I would definitely take an option to not, unrelated to the virus.
I think I would like to do. I wouldn't mind staying just a couple of days. I don't really like the idea.
That'd be great.
I mean, it does feel pretty bloated now so we went a whole year, 3 hours a day, and then you're gonna tell me next year they need three extra hours after that? Wait, hold on. What are we talking about here? Like, I mean,
yeah,
I don't even know if that's really good for my kids. If you're not gonna offer something better than that, why do you send them back? I just don't think it's as good.
I'm with you there. If it's like you're just talking about what they do in school, it might not need to be as much, but I don't need them every morning 4 hours they need to be in front of the computer. Like, if they can go to school 2 days a week and get all what they need to, all the learning they need to get done.
Yeah.
And then I can take them to the zoo and the aquarium or whatever.
Or they can read a book on the other days or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, that's fine. But
there's a whole nother landscape out there. I bet the people just don't see it, but I can see it with what's happened. And I really think that the situation of school at Georgia and stuff is unique, but there's a new way of looking at this. I'll just give you a little picture of it, but it's like more about the ongoing digital present relationship with a person that she has. So she has a real relationship with this teacher and an inbox and assignments, just like I have an email relationship with Toby and Devin and stuff. Like, it's accountable and fluid, and it's in the actual domain that humans work and live in. So it's almost more realistic, basically. It's a lot less like factory training. More like training you to do ongoing, asynchronous, intelligent knowledge work. Like
email
just
job.
Just to be connected and doing a thing. I mean, that's a really neat concept to be.
Yeah.
It's funny. I just got an email while we were talking about this. Buddy's T-ball little league teacher or coach has COVID. Practice stands.
Oh, God.
So you could have it right now.
It's funny talking about this, though, because what it seems like more and more school is to teach you, wait a minute, if you work in this system hard, you'll get something out of it that'll benefit future you, right? But then future you just does the exact same thing except for money. You get paid this time instead of, you know, but that now we're all also realizing that money isn't real. And and God knows whatever the hell I mean, for the longest time I've been thinking, I always thought it was so stupid when the news would talk about our debt, or you'd see the debt clock or whatever rolling and all stuff. And I was like, who cares? That's just so stupid. And now I go, wait a minute, what is anything financial? Yeah. And so, I mean, money isn't real. So wait, you went to school. All that really tried to teach you was work in this system. We're going to teach you. But the overall thing they teach you is learn this thing that I'm telling you and do what I say, basically, for all these years. And then you'll get out and be in the exact same thing almost, except for, oh yeah, we will give you this money. But it's just it doesn't mean anything. And so, I mean, one of the big things that's going to happen is people start pulling their kids back, and then they'll say, why we got to pay so much taxes? And then there won't be as many bus driver jobs. There won't be as many, you know, staff and cafeteria where all the stuff, it's all going to go away, and it'll just, there won't be anything. But anyway, I was out there for a little bit. But money ain't real.
Yeah, that's the out there part. Is UBI, if you've made the whole school's all employee training, and then there's no work for people to do, or money doesn't mean anything. That's the scary prospects that's the whole collapse of things at that point.
Yeah. Our national religion has been a belief in that this paper that we hold in our pocket has value. And if we all believe that it has value, then we can transfer value within each other. We can get goods and services with this paper. But if we stop believing in that paper and I pass it to you, Toby, and you say, I don't want the fucking paper.
Right.
Then the whole thing falls apart. There's nothing. We don't have an economy. So
you can feel people thinking that though.
They're starting to think that.
It's like the real knowledge from the people that understand that the economy is like this positive something that you're able to generate based on belief in that narrative is real, and that is the system. But the fact that the common man is coming to understand that, and a bunch of ladies groups doing stocks, my aunt and my Bridget's cousins doing stocks, and all the crypto everything, that everybody understands you can create a coin, hype it, and then you actually can withdraw that money.
Yeah, I don't think anybody
that's dangerous knowledge that's now down in the hands of the common man.
Nobody knew how much human collective belief could delude themselves. Like how much we could, just by believing in GameStop, create a surplus of billions of dollars
that people can spend.
That you can spend. But it's just collective belief. Mm-hmm. It's just religion. GameStop's not worth that. Correct. You know?
Yes.
We all just decided it was one day. And then everyone accepted it for a minute. And then eventually people decided it wasn't and went back down.
Well, it was
just the magic of human belief.
Gold was good. It's like, well, we got the gold, you know? So obviously it's real. It's gold. We have it. So.
You're right. That minute, though, was like my dad's age group or something like that. You know what I mean? Like those boomers, whatever. Like my dad worked his whole life for money. He thought, I gotta get more of that. That's the thing that'll keep me alive, help my family, do all this stuff. And I think now that he's, you know, late 60s, he in his mind, I think he thinks to some level, he can't totally tell himself that, but it wasn't worth it. What was that?
Right.
I mean, this is the only life I had, and I did what? I went to this building every day for all these years and tried to get overtime so I could, and, you know, he's not even that happy. And so the happiness and feelings are the most important things now to everybody, including me, and it's our number one truth. And so once you start realizing, wait, my feelings, I don't want to go to this workplace.
I want to do this.
Then it really is over. If everybody just goes, wait a minute, I want to pursue joy. Well, then, I mean, you always didn't do that because, well, you got to have enough money. So don't be an idiot and go play a rock band in Seattle. You know, but now
did you watch the new Adam Curtis documentary? Can't Get You Out of My Head.
It's on I just heard him talk on Red Scare though. That
okay.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love you, Dasha.
Yeah, love you, Tasha. A lot of what you're saying reminds me of kind of what he gets at, and he gets at in that interview too on Red Scare. But there's just a free documentary on YouTube. It's called "Can't Get You Out of My Head" by Adam Curtis, and it's basically a bunch of series of like how the emotional history of how he got to where we are here, and it's his artistic take and everything. And it's not like he did it emotionally, purely to be kind of anti-rational because everything's so hyper rational now. But what he's talking about is just what you were saying, which is like so much of it is about our feelings and motivated by our own personal feelings and beliefs and a lot of this narrative and myth and stuff. And we get sold a big line, and then at the end of our lives we're like, wait a minute, what exactly was this, you know? And I think a lot of people are waking up to that and trying to figure out how to subvert it or, you know, come up with new ways to create value that aren't in these legacy systems or ways to, like, I don't know, solve problems that aren't like don't have all these negative externalities that we see, like with capitalism and everything, like all the subjugation of other people and other countries for labor and all that stuff. So I think we're definitely nearing a point where, like, something has to give, and no one really knows what it is, but everyone's grasping.
Or something new has to be created, though. That's the something. There's another way of thinking about it too.
Right.
That there's just a whole new future, and this is the end of something. And that's
a paradigm,
actually the way that I think about it.
Yeah,
but think of how
thin
this is, though. Either this is the most thin, brittle, meaningless nothing, or you can see a glimpse of the future. I think if you could take just that idea that GameStop, for instance, was that, or some other coin is able to, just from information and code, create value that is then withdrawable and spendable, right? That's an amazing concept. So, okay, so maybe if you can understand that that's not fake, but it is a real thing to harness. But then you take that money out, and now what do people spend it on? But something like an NFT. Now, yeah. How thin, and that, can you imagine an economy or a system that's that razor thin, where it's built on hype and then spent on not real things? Yikes!
Well,
isn't
I mean,
that so scary?
It is.
But
real.
You could maybe you can get that stable and then build. Then it, maybe it's full abundance from on the other side of that somehow. If it could really, if we could really solve all the coordination problems and you know get it together, you might could build a whole new level of reality that is. Doesn't have all the externalities if you could coordinate it right. It's really got to be possible, and we might not thread that needle, but
right.
It, but I mean, it's always been there, but now it's just in the digital space. I mean, Devin and I were talking about it the other day. I mean, a baseball card was just a cheap piece of cardboard with not good graphics on it, and you know, I mean, just an ugly old picture, or whatever. But it just gained in value depending on which one you had. Same as Pokemon cards and all that stuff. And my kids did that. So it's all made up. But that,
but it's, the value's real and you can
the value
get
is
it.
Real. And with crypto, though, if enough people agree that these certain things are worth something, then it just will be and the people will decide. That's
so
pretty wild, right?
Autograph.
Is that how it's going to work? Like, will the people decide what crypto is real?
Yeah.
Which one?
People decide what an NFT is worth based on what they're going to pay for. It's just like the open free market. But an NFT is its value is tied to its scarcity and the fact that it is provably scarce. Digital scarcity is a thing now when it's locked on the blockchain. Like if I send you an NFT, that transaction is forever logged. I mean, if assuming that the Ethereum blockchain survives and whatever fork happens in the future, you can go back to that. What? Did they cut it out?
You goddamn
cleaning
ladies.
Oh, my God.
Tell
gosh.
Them to turn the internet back on. They heard you talking.
Hang on. Give me 1 second. I'm going to switch to the 5G one.
Right. Tell them goddamn white cleaning ladies.
And they're talking about these nifties. What the hell's wrong with you?
I did call my parents last week and told them, hey, can y'all send me all my baseball cards?
Yeah.
From when I was a kid. I have thousands of them. I have no idea what's in them.
Man, there's so many people that sold them, and that's pretty awesome. I mean, you probably have at least some that
I've
are
some.
Worth something.
I don't know. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, you go over and you trade baseball cards. You didn't know you were trading. You're like, oh, I got this Daryl Strawberry for this Doc Gooden or something. Like, maybe I have something really good.
It's really popular now. I mean, people are putting a shitload of money into baseball cards again.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same. It's just a physical NFT.
Mac, you're going to have to repeat the NFT description, which is probably worth doing.
So,
can you hear us?
So, basically, sorry about that. I'm back. Basically, when I transfer the ownership of something, non-fungible means like, you know, if I have a $5 bill and you have something that's worth $5, we can transfer if you have a $5 bill and I have a $5 bill, we can trade those two things and it's equal value. But a non-fungible token is like something that's completely unique. It has its own hash on the blockchain. So like if I transfer it to you, like you can't copy it, you can't duplicate, no one can take it from you. And so it's this digital item. It's digital scarcity is what they've kind of figured out. Now, when we all came from the physical music space where we printed CDs or tapes or whatever, now we do vinyl for the old schoolers. But like, and then we moved into this digital space, our music could suddenly be copied a billion times. And there's upsides and downsides to that. Obviously, economically, without any scarcity, you don't have value. So our music got devalued. So now they're figuring out ways to get in the digital space, digital scarcity and ownership, to reinstall value back into digital IP. So I'm excited about it because this is like, as a musician and someone who creates something that is always streamable and downloadable and copyable, it's a way to make something unique that, you know, you can't copy and hold and retain value for a long time. So that's an NFT.
I believe that that's the both... You really want both extremes and not the soft middle of consumer art. Like there's the NFT concept and then as much copying as possible also. Like, you really want a unique object to be unique, and you want to pay for it.
Yeah, there will always be things that are off-chain, for sure. And like you said, like Spotify or streaming or whatever, that's good. Like, that's how you get, that's how you on-ramp people. But if you're going to do like a custom NFT or an exclusive digital song or, lyric sheets or music videos, you can store all this on the blockchain, and you can limit the amount that goes out. You can customize things. That's just more depth.
Do you think
depth.
A demo would make a good one? Like, let's just say Taking Back Sunday's making a new record, and the single that's big, there's the voice memo that Adam Lazara made of it when he had the idea. Is that something somebody could own in a scarce way?
Yeah.
And wouldn't that be cool if you said, I have it, even he doesn't have it anymore? I mean, there could be a copy of it out there. You'd just be able to prove that yours was the special one.
I'm in a weird spot, because like the space hasn't been defined yet. Now there's a concept where people are like, I own the NFT for that song, which is sort of like saying like I own the certificate or the
authenticity certificate or something.
Yeah, right. Like it's like I'm a shareholder, but I'm the main shareholder in that song or something like that. And they can display it on these different NFT sites. OpenSea or whatever, you can go to your profile, and there's your NFT collection, and it actually has a value. Like, people will try to, you know, offer you money for your NFTs or whatever. But so I kind of like, I've thought about this, because I'm gonna make some. I'm actually in the process of doing it right now. I've got the whole plan set up, but whether I put the demo on or the finished product, I'm like, there's a toss up. Because I don't necessarily want the demo to be immortalized on the blockchain, but like, it will if I put it on there.
Yeah,
it will potentially outlast the recorded music,
and most likely have more value.
Yes,
and which, like, let's just say you're a prominent, it's just big, and then a long time from now, there's legendary status attached to a song you put out. That demo is like having Kurt Cobain's guitar or whatever. Like, you have it, the tape that he recorded, Teen Spirit demo, and you're holding it in your hand. You say, this is the moment when it went to tape that idea. I mean, I have this.
I guess it's
millions of dollars, you know?
Yeah, it's a good idea to have it be the demo, though, because it is unique. It's not something that's released in the mainstream. So, like, it's not, you can't stream it on Spotify. It's going to be unique to
it. You wouldn't care that much about list streaming it, even. You care about, you own this thing. It's like when we were in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they had the lyric sheet for Hey Jude, not the one he made after the fact for his Kickstarter, but when he came up with that word, those two words in order, that phrase, it was that moment on this piece of paper in England in this year, and here it is right here. That could be a digital thing too, and it would. Yeah. Of course, it's obviously.
I mean, maybe
really
you are selling me on the
if you securely demo. Had it.
Yeah, maybe you are selling me on the demo. Demo might be the idea.
It's memorabilia, is the way.
Sorry
I see
if I'm
it.
Cutting out.
Yeah, it's there's something museum. Yeah, you're cutting out a little bit, but it's something museum-like about it more than owning the IP rights or whatever. That just give that away. What, you know. Give the song, the song's whatever. Just
there'll be copies, the same as a painting. There's a shitload of Picassos that, you know, they sell at stores that are just prints. But the real one, if you got to see the real one, it would really mean something to you. You know what I mean? You've seen those paintings a million times, but the real one would be something. And somebody would go, the value of your demo probably would be pretty high, because you go, oh, that's how they get to the thing that everybody knows. Well, guess what? I had the thing that got it there. That'd be kind of cool.
Right. It's the original. Yeah. This is the original iteration of that song before it was released to all the platforms that you can stream it for free on.
Yeah. So if you went back in time and could get, like I said, Kurt Cobain's tape, he did in a cassette recorder, you'd like it. If you had Chris Carrabba's Dashboard one, you would like it. Now, trick is, he did it on digital. Oh, I don't want that. No, you still want it. Now we have a way to actually make that happen in the scarce way.
Right.
So that's like, to me, it's the realest. It's super obviously real. Like, the it's not a silly concept, but it's a matter of what are the right applications that will be meaningful. But you're going to sell these things for $50, and then one day they'll be worth some other astronomical amount.
Well, that's the thing. It's the secondary market
and,
with
and
NFTs.
It'll be secondary. Yeah, it won't be your money. You'll sell.
It's not your money. Yeah, yeah. Right. So a lot of people sell an NFT for, you know, one or two ETH, and then it turns around and someone's selling it for 20 or 30 ETH, and they will get that money for it just because suddenly there's hype and demand and all these you know, shitcoiners are pumping up the price and stuff. And I don't necessarily want to do it like as a, I don't want to make a crypto collectible for like the shitcoiners and the Bitcoiners and the whoever else that wants to, you know, own some piece of history because they're trading cryptocurrencies all day. I'm trying to make something for the fans that will last like in the digital and virtual space.
Yeah.
That's a piece of something that's really unique from us. So I'm in this weird spot where like if I launch and mint my NFTs, are some prospecting crypto douchebags going to come in and buy them and then turn around and resell them to my own
fans for 10 times the amount. Yes,
for
will.
10 times the amount, because that's going to piss me off. But there's nothing much I can do about that. Right. I mean, there is a bit of smart contracting that I can do, perhaps, where I build that into the NFT. It's like, in order to buy this, you have to check a bunch of boxes or something.
Can't sell it for a bunch of years or something. Or,
yeah, or something know, like or... that. Yeah. 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 You can't sell it for a bunch of years.
Vinyl is like that. I think people collect and own vinyl just to get in that zone more than they listen to it. I know people listen to it, but a lot of people don't listen so much to the vinyls, but they still find value in
they want a physical representation of the, and they put the art up on the wall, like I mean I have it, you know, I like to pull it out and be like, I have this record, and sometimes I'm not even listening to the record, it's just like, hey, yeah, I like this one's good.
It's beautiful in a way to be able to enter into getting value from abstractions is what I'm saying. That is real value is created that people can participate in and enjoy the benefits from, and it's mostly abstract value. That's not bad. That's good. Like, that's how everything's not a zero sum game out here.
Right.
There's new. You can do more.
Well, last time we did this podcast, we were talking about this massive transition from the physical reality to the virtual and digital space. And this year has kind of like brought that all full circle. Like, so many people, like, we're talking about school, they're doing remote schooling, or they're doing remote work. And like, how do you bring the things that make the physical realm special? And that it really is scarcity. It really is the limitation of the physical realm that makes it special for the human. And so if you can bring scarcity into the virtual space where not everything is just like this, like, you have something unique and special that no one can copy. That brings that special part of physical reality into that space and makes it richer, makes it more human.
We're still at a weird time, too, though, because digital is fake. It's not the real world. People still like saying that, you know, that online stuff. People are still weird sometimes when they say online dating or, you know, like, all the, even e-dating. Though it's completely real, they think that even though it's completely real and a part of their life, Facebook's just that online stuff. I need the tactile real thing. So we built ourselves into thinking that, oh, yeah, it's just something on the internet. Why would you pay money for that? I mean, you could just see it. I watch stuff online all day. Why would I pay for that? It's not a real thing.
And but it is. And so you can get it now, like
it
when
is,
people thought
but not
it didn't
to
matter.
People, yeah.
Like land, you just give it away. We used to give away land in the United States where people pay hundreds of thousands
That's
of dollars.
That's what I'm saying.
Now,
we're not there yet, though.
Give it away. And that is what this is right now. There's digital assets and IP and all this stuff. It has no value, but it will.
Yeah.
It's going to just get figured out, and it will.
Yeah, these NFTs become stores of value that the market sort of dictates. It is kind of like because your, let's say your cryptocurrency is just a number in your wallet, right? But if you have things to display in your wallet, it really is hacking into the human psyche a little bit, because like, why do people use Instagram? Well, most of the time it's to show off. It's to show off their family or their house or their car or their vacation or what they're doing. And they're showing these things of these unique, scarce experiences or people that are in their life. And they're saying, look what I have that's unique to me that you don't have, essentially. And not all of it's like trying to like you know, make people feel bad. But the end result is usually that. But that's what NFTs are. It's like, look what I have that you can't actually get. And it's doing that in the virtual space where before everybody can have everything in the virtual space. You just download it. But now you can't. And so now there's going to be this comparison thing where people are looking at what other people have and they're saying, suddenly that has value and you will never, there's no rationality with what has value and what doesn't. There's these digital like crypto punks that are like these pixelated features and everything. And they're going for tens of thousands of dollars. Yeah. And it's nothing. It was just a collection. Someone just, it's like a Pokemon card set basically that someone made. And they sold like 3 years ago. And now that because they're sort of like these original NFTs, they're worth a ton. So
there's a real distinction to make here then that there is a such thing as irrationally priced NFTs and rationally priced NFTs though. So it's not, there's no, like people would want to say it's all irrational, but it's not. It's if it is backed by real meaning.
Right.
Then the fact that it's digital is irrelevant. But sometimes you can have this hyperinflated, irrationally priced thing that's obviously unstable or whatever, too.
Well, you could say that hype is irrational, but hype is monetizable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after a certain amount of time, like we saw with GameStop or AMC or whatever, it's like after a certain amount of time, like, you know, if it's hyped enough for a certain amount of time and it's limited and it's scarce, it's always going to retain some value because it owns real estate in the psyche and the history of the ledger and the American people and whatever, whoever was involved in it. Mm-hmm. You know, these things came out called hash masks, and they're these digital art pieces that were just going for insane amounts in the secondary market. And it was kind of a meme, like their Twitter account sucked and they didn't know what they were doing, but they like all these people pounced on it and now it's worth a ton. And it's like, I don't think that's going to go down necessarily because it just owns this real estate in the minds of people now.
Yeah, that's true.
As a unique thing that happened.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you mean like you used to would hear what went in and out of style, but if you're just marketed to, it's almost, you could almost stabilize that value more so. Like who's ever going to tell them that nobody cares anymore?
Yeah. But everyone who was there, who saw that thing take off for those 2 weeks and really revolutionize the collectible market in NFTs are going to be like, yeah, you remember Hashmax, or you remember the CryptoKitties, or do you remember
the punks? Because that gives them their own historical context that probably creates
it's
even
like
more
the
value.
Hardee's raisins.
Yeah, the California raisins.
The California raisins. Exactly.
I had three or four of those. God, I wish I'd have kept them. Shit.
That kind of stuff's worth, I mean, it always will be, but think about, you're right that it's like, it's just that scarcity that matters. An extreme example would be cars, because cars, you know how cars values are super weird, like a very weird thing, especially old or classic cars. If you could 3D print a beautiful 65 Mustang, and so could everybody, then you would just say, well, this car sucks.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of cool, but if everybody had one, then the coolness is gone, and the brakes aren't very good, and it's just not really a good car by modern standards, so it would just seem stupid. But right now, they're worth unlimited. I'm not unlimited, but I went to McDonald's. I'm glad this gives me an opportunity to tell this story, but I went to McDonald's. To one of the reasons I love living in Seattle is because I always see nice cars and airplanes, and just there's enough rich people here that you see nice things periodically, and that's of value to me. And I was getting in the McDonald's line, and I just saw this car. I was like, holy shit. And it was like a 67 Mustang Shelby Cobra, like an unbelievable car, an unbelievable car. And I just, I'm going to get in the McDonald's line behind this thing and get to look at it for 5 minutes. This is going to be, and this fucking lady in a Prius pulled in front of me and blocked my view of that car for the most painful 7 minutes of my life where I could. And she's not looking at it. She didn't notice the damn thing. My view is blocked the whole time. And the person that could have really appreciated this look at that car for 5 minutes didn't even get to look at it. Damn. It made me so mad. I was like all angry. Like I felt angry that whole time. I couldn't look at it.
That Prius person probably hated that car too. Right?
I know. I'm sure. I'm just sure. Hated it. I couldn't believe it. It was like a TV show. It was like late, and all of a sudden, whoop! Like, I'm not mad they're in front of me in the McDonald's line. That wasn't why I was mad, but I was pretty upset.
It's still though. What's crazy about all this is it feels like it's so there's huge variables with it, it swings with it. It could go either way. Like, it means something today and just doesn't later. Like, I mean. Just like we were talking about COVID earlier, nobody knows the number, what exactly, you don't have real data on it. I mean, nobody really knows with even like Bitcoin, right? It's just an agreed upon thing that we think has some value.
We're all kind of going along with it.
We're just kind of going along with it. And so maybe it'll stay
the
real.
Hard questions. You don't right. really, but get going on this.
That means it could be not real. There's a solid percentage chance that it isn't, right?
Mm-hmm. There's a solid percentage chance that the U.S. dollar isn't real.
That's true. Yeah, I agree. Actually, I think that's what we're finding out now. Yeah.
It's backed by less than Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So you can't print more Bitcoin, but you can print more U.S. dollars. And they do, periodically whenever they need more money.
That's the argument why Bitcoin would – that's why if it was unencumbered and adopted as a standard.
Yeah. Like, it's actually scarce.
The scarcity actually is real forever, so it can't be inflated or whatever. It can be – so it can't really get inflation? It can only just have volatility of its actual value, though.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I mean, there are –
But it can't
there
be
are,
mechanically yeah. inflated, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, even the – creator of it.
It's
it
digital
like
gold.
A Satoshi or whatever. It sounds like a video game or something.
Satoshi Nakamoto.
That just seems like it has to be we live in a simulation then. If our Satoshi.
He disappeared.
No one's ever even seen him, have they?
No one's ever seen him. He disappeared. No one knows. I mean, this guy, Hal, I forget his last name, Hal something. He was the first guy to tweet anything about Bitcoin. And he wrote Running Bitcoin. And so it's like it's an ongoing meme. He did that in 2009 or 8 on Twitter. And he was running Bitcoin. He was basically one of the first guys to mine Bitcoin. And he actually died. So some people thought that he was his pseudonym was Satoshi Nakamoto. But other people say that they actually wrote differently and they didn't type the same stuff. So, yeah, I mean, it could have been someone from the future who was like, okay, we need to create a technology that fixes what's going to be the world's greatest disaster. And digital scarcity is the way to do it. And Bitcoin's that technology. I mean, who knows, right? I mean, that's kind of the perfect thing about it is that it was anonymously started and then it was open source developed.
Mm-hmm.
So... Yep. So this is a true like community thing. Like there are no more like whales who got in early, who now can manipulate the market. Like everybody
well distributed.
You can sell. Yeah. I mean, there are people that own billions worth and these are massive investment companies. Mm-hmm. But they had to buy them. So they got in for free, you know? So. What?
You froze.
I froze?
Yeah.
Damn it.
Man, it's just getting terrible over there in Seattle.
I'm sorry, man.
Okay, explain this to me, because I literally do not know this. So this Satoshi guy, whoever he is, hid stuff?
There's a buried treasure somewhere. Like, whoever cracked.
Yeah, exactly that. You know, like those old chase movies and stuff like that. Where somebody hid something under this tree, and if you can find it, you know, you'll get. But like, what are they mining? And when they mine something, they pull it out. What is that thing?
So these computers
that's a bit called a Bitcoin. But what?
Yeah.
Where is it?
These computers. So it's this.
Toby's representing every man quite well at the moment. Keep on going.
What it's the fuck is it?
Where are the Bitcoins?
Motherfucker, tell me what the fuck it is.
Think of it in terms like this. It's a computer program that rewards Bitcoin to people who are verifying transactions. So it's like a peer-to-peer verification of a transaction. So if you're a miner, your main job is to verify transactions on the blockchain, so on the ledger. So someone tries to send a Bitcoin from one address to another. It comes through you. You verify that that Bitcoin is moving, and you put it on the blockchain that it's now going to that place over there. And so that's how nobody can have, you know, two people can't have the same Bitcoin. You have to, you know, essentially for simplicity's sake, you have to be verified, right?
Okay.
So as they're verifying stuff, their computers are doing these increasingly complicated math problems, essentially. And that's what gets them more Bitcoin out of the program. Yeah. Now, there's only 21 million total supply, and over 18 million have been mined. But every so often, it gets twice as hard to get a Bitcoin out of the supply.
And that was all encoded intentionally on purpose as a system.
It's part of the code.
A white paper that Satoshi character wrote. So he just said, he dropped a document that said, I have your financial future world and peaced out. Run this program.
Basically,
y'all figure out how to run it. This is it. And he gave a code, a piece of DNA, a sheet of instructions, a white paper, came from his mind, and then became the reality.
He basically created digital scarcity. And you can't hack it. You can't steal it. Once this ledger is on 200,000 computers, if I come in and say, oh, I have a Bitcoin, the 199,999,000 they're going to look at me and be like, no, you don't. We have the ledger here. So it really verifies the scarcity. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
That's what decentralization is. Not one bank has the ledger or one central group controls it.
I see.
It's on everyone's computer.
Well, thank you for explaining that. All right. Let's all take a guess. Maybe you can get more than one, but you have to do at least one guess of who you think Satoshi is. I'll go first. All right. Okay. I feel confident in this. Bill Cosby. How horrific would that be?
Yeah.
How horrific. Who do y'all think it is?
Either that guy on Twitter or aliens, according to McDonald.
Yeah. Oh, I think,
somebody from the future.
Sammy Hagar.
There's a chance it's Elon Musk.
What if it was him? I mean, it might be.
There's a chance.
I think, I'm not saying it's him, but it, or anything, but
listen, Elon started PayPal, which was a payments company, and it's almost like he was trying to do crypto, but they had to go legit.
And so
it's the most likely guess, right? Like, who else could you guess that would be?
Who else could you guess? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think he doesn't know.
Jared
from
Subway. I want it to be somebody horrific where you're like, oh no, I own this much Bitcoin. I'm a terrible
person.
Doesn't
even matter. I mean, yeah.
So with that legend would be that somebody like Elon was trying to solve the money problem or understood the value of digital currency or even scarcity.
Right.
And along the way came up with the idea, but realized it was not, you know, the way to unleash it would have to be in that way to actually have it have the desired effect or something. And he did PayPal just to make money to do the other things, but it had to be released in that way. It couldn't be done for like outwardly.
Right.
And so it's part of a long strategy somehow.
Realistically, you're going up against a lot of forces that have vested interest in probably seeing you, whoever came up with this thing dead. So like the pseudonym is definitely, warranted. And then, I think probably honestly, whoever it was probably is dead at this point. Either that or they're some kind of like saint.
Damn.
Yeah.
The third party option makes more sense. Like I don't know. Because I mean, in the end, it's still like way unclear that one will win out. Like somebody else can improve that technology and make a difference. I mean, maybe Ethereum takes off or I don't know what. So, I mean, it's not that it was it necessarily still is going to be the cryptocurrency that's adopted for the cosmos, but it could be, or another one could be.
Yeah, it's just like you're not going to get rid of gold because gold's the original scarce rare metal. In the virtual space, I don't think you'll ever get rid of Bitcoin. As far as like utility and like You know, people aren't going to build swords out of gold. You know,
you think it'll remain impractical, but a high value store of value like gold.
A high store of value like gold. Yeah, yeah. Like, but like, you're not going to transact. I don't think you'll necessarily transact with it. Like, for instance, I'm into cryptocurrencies. I own a lot of different ones, but if I'm investing, I'm buying a Bitcoin. And then I'm
Let me try another analogy. We're out humans scouring the earth, investigating, searching for things. We found a diamond. Awesome. There's diamonds now. So we find a bunch of diamonds. And then people are like, I got a ruby over here. I got a sapphire. Is this worth anything? You know, and then it's like, then eventually, so Bitcoin and not, you know, is one or the first or the primary or the ultimate, the benchmark, you know, new jewel. Or precious metal discovered. It'll behave like that.
That Donald Trump invented.
Yeah. So the longer that Bitcoin runs, the more valuable. Yeah, it'd be hilarious. The more valuable it is. Like, it has the longest going ledger. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of has the biggest amount of value because its value is most provable.
True.
Like, yeah. So it's.
Would Donald Trump supporters believe if he came out? I'm Satoshi.
Yeah, he might.
They might believe him, right?
He might say if it became a real popular thing, then he would probably just do that.
Yeah, he'd just say he is Satoshi. Yeah.
Al Gore said he invented the internet.
Yeah, it almost works. Yeah, it works.
I mean, he said it. He said he did it.
What if Al Gore is Satoshi?
I just can't believe how quickly. I mean, it feels like everything in my life is just changing, and I guess maybe every generation thinks that I get it, but it just feels like my daughter today, she said that she used to like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. She said she was obsessed with it. She said, I was like, no, you weren't, whatever. But she's like, but Dad, you know what, on the internet the other day I saw these Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and it was the most bizarre thing I've ever seen in my life. And I don't, she said, you probably, have you ever seen that? It's really strange. And she was just talking about the original cartoon I watched when I was in elementary school and thought it was awesome, right? So, yeah. I mean, from that to we're talking about the U.S. dollar is gone, maybe. It's just insane, right?
Yeah.
That I went from the 80s, which was like, yeah, you know, stock, you know, Wall Street and money and, Reagan and all the stuff and Chicago Bears, you know, and all this, and now to America is gone. It's gone.
Okay, walk us through it again.
Chicago Bears.
Ninja Turtles.
Yes.
Then the old Ninja Turtles. Then the Chicago Bears. Then America's gone.
Okay, Nirvana.
It does seem abrupt. I'll admit.
Oh, I see your point. So Nirvana, and now America's gone. So.
We don't live here anymore. It's not ours.
We don't own any of this. We're not anywhere.
It's unbelievable.
That's kind of true. We're not really anywhere. I mean, that's kind of like maybe the Adam Curtis guy said we're like a haunted. Like, we're not. That was kind of strong language. But my grandparents lived in the craziest life of like the top of the whole thing. But they were, you know, retired. In Greer, my country club, the Rotary Club, a bridge night, you know, the church involved, you know, it's like 30 things socially in the community of Greer in the 60s. And then when I'm a little kid in the 80s, you know, my grandparents were, all people had to go to the lake. You do, it was just, there's so many things they're really, really active in that were deep things.
Yeah.
Season tickets to Clemson. I mean, what do we do?
Yeah. Culturally, what do we do?
We just don't do anything.
Mm. Right.
You know, so that, I mean, they had a lot of meaning in their life that we don't have at anything close to.
It's funny.
Yeah, we're here right now.
Yeah. I mean, we do this. I like it.
And we get excited about people talking to each other and listening to them. We don't know them.
But, I mean, that's what Bridge is about, is just to get people. I mean, I don't know. That's what we're doing now. We're making an excuse to do something, to make something mean something. That's all this is. But we're very limited. And it's like, you would think we'd have more, but we don't. We have a lot less to do.
I think it's crazy when you think back to, I can remember when we got our original NES, the Nintendo. Isn't it funny that you got that a video gaming system before you got a computer, well before you ever got a laptop or a home computer or anything? Like, everybody was getting these computer systems that would attach to your television and create this whole thing, and it's all this games and stuff, but way before you got a computer to do things with. And those game systems were probably better than what you could have gotten as a computer at your house. I mean, I know they existed then, but I'm saying there wasn't much to do on an internet or anything like that. It was all just plotting lines and stuff.
You're right that most people's first computers was probably a Nintendo. And you remember, if you say it'd be you versus CPU, you'd say computers, a central processing unit. Right. I mean, you didn't think you needed a computer, but you were playing against the CPU.
Yeah.
You know.
Now it might own us and enslave us.
You lost.
I told you. I promise you it's over.
Lost. Could you make it a little bit more concrete of what is exactly over that you promise?
Everything.
So, Chicago Bears. Chicago Bears, gone.
What is it?
Stock
over?
Market, gone.
Yeah, it'd be easier if y'all told me what is it over.
Reagan, dead.
You name it, it's gone.
What, as Kurzweil said, what, like 2040?
I don't know what his year is.
Was the Great Reckoning? What is it? What do they call the Great Reckoning?
The singularity.
End of all things? Yeah, that too.
Singularity.
I thought it was 2040. Like, he said it was going to be in 40 years, and I thought that was, you know, in the year 2000 or something like that. But, I mean, that's going to be – that's not the end of us, of civilization, or – Well, let's don't get into it. Forget it. I don't even like the way you just huffed and puffed. It turned me off.
I'm just saying.
It turned me off. I'm done. I'm on to something else.
There's beginnings of things, and ends of things are usually, you know, just the new things and different things. Is, you know, some things end and other things begin, but it's hard to know what they will be. But that does seem to be the what it feels like right now. This, you know, new things though.
Yeah.
Or nothing forever. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, nothing forever, nothing could matter. Or you try, it's like fundamentally it's nihilism or optimism at some point. Like, are we going to go for it though? That's what I'm asking. Like,
you tell me how things keep going when you find out Jeffrey Epstein made Bitcoin.
He's the creator of it,
and that's why they shut him down.
Yeah.
And honestly, killed him in prison.
I did say he was dead, so.
I mean, I can't even talk anymore. Y'all done tore me up. McDonald, y'all doing, what are y'all doing? Some shows with Vocal Few?
Yeah, we're doing Saturday nights on Twitch. Every Saturday night, twitch.tv/theclassicmatt. We're doing acoustic classic crime songs, Vocal Few songs, but mostly drink. It's mostly just like a date night where we drink. Yeah.
That's a creating a hang and a digital environment.
It's a very hang, and it's very like casual. I like it because we don't really practice beforehand, so we just kind of like just try to off the top of our head in a very casual setting play our songs or play my songs that I haven't played in years. So it's kind of fun. It's fun because it's like low pressure, and sometimes it's great. Sometimes it's, you know, okay.
What? But. How do you think of the main reason to do something like that? I'm gonna get on every Saturday night and do it. Like, Chrissy and I,
like, she just loves to perform, and she's mostly a mom all the time, so she feels like she's not like we normally tour in the summer. We didn't tour last summer, so like for her motivation is like, I just want to play. I just want to, you know, I want to do something with you. I want to be in that band with you again, because that was fun. And for me, it is kind of like a date night, I guess, in a way. It's like we're doing something together. We kind of have a history of doing stuff together that's like outward facing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the day, I mean, yeah, it's taken on different, you know, things over the time. But like, that's we like doing stuff together that's not just raising kids. So,
I mean, you could just start your couples OnlyFans and be done.
I know,
with
right?
It.
Yeah.
Couples only fans. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. What are they going to do with porn and NFTs? Can I own a digital tit?
Yeah.
There's a guy that's actually selling his left and right tit as NFTs right now. It's a meme lord on Twitter is doing that. Yeah,
that's interesting. Shit. I mean, celebrities will just sell. I mean, they'll just like sell every frame of their life to somebody, like a sale of a cartoon. Like, you know how a sale of a cartoon's worth something? You think Shia LaBeouf could just sell 60 frames a second of his life as NFTs?
Yeah, I mean, what if Brad Pitt just drove to like a bunch of cities in America or the world and then just showed picture to him in your city and you have a picture of Brad Pitt in your city?
Well, it's not that different than when we used to get Ron Gant to sign a baseball card. You just fly him in, he sits there and he NFTs a bunch of cardboard.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and you pay whatever you pay, and he does it, and it creates the value, and you got it. I don't know.
Right,
it's going to be crazy.
But now you can tell how many copies
are,
because it's forever stored, you know? It's not like the guy signed, you know, 30,000 baseballs, and you got one of them, you know? Like, you don't know how many are out there. Mm-hmm. You know what the market value is, I guess, if you have someone, you know, appraise it for you. But
I have one. It's probably worth $3.
Yeah, I've got it. I think it costs
Ron Gant baseball.
I think it costs $9 to get his autograph when it happened. I thought $9.
Now I did catch I caught a Ron Gant home run ball in the air with my glove.
That's amazing.
No way.
Yeah, it was. My dad has the video of it.
That'll make you a fan.
Well, he was on the Cardinals, but
it was late.
Yeah.
Damn.
We just went too deep. Nobody knows who the fuck Ron is.
I should have said Dave Justice.
Nobody, yeah, I know. No, that's not even. I know. Ken Griffey. It's like Ken Griffey or no, say Ken nobody. Griffey.
Ron Gant's body was like a rock. It was like chiseled in stone. Yeah. I mean, he was like a superhero to me, like a real life action figure or something.
No, he looked like, he looked like a Captain America or something. Yeah. That's how his arms were.
It was so
unbelievable.
Great.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just so amazing. Like, I just thought looked like the coolest person on earth.
You know, he does morning TV now. Like,
he does?
Yeah, in Atlanta. He just says morning TV. Like, just like early. Al Roker or something like that, you know? Just
like The View.
Yeah.
That's great.
And he invented Bitcoin. Ron Gant is worth a trillion dollars. Bitcoin.
Jose Canseco would be cool if he was Satoshi. People would like that, I think.
That would be amazing.
He tweeted Jose.
He just woke up from a dream, had the idea.
Yeah.
Done.
He wouldn't be begging people to come down to his car wash.
Yeah, his car wash. Yeah. He was tweeting today about his car wash. He's gonna be out. Yeah. At the car wash.
He's very in need of money. So
I wrote him to try and get him on this podcast, and he never responded.
You offer him $500, he'll do it.
Yeah, you're probably right. You're probably exactly right. So
he's incredible. I mean, he calls people clowns.
Oh, yeah. He hates A-Rod on Twitter.
You see that fight he was just in, and he got knocked out, like, immediately?
Yeah. Yes.
It's crazy.
Yes.
Just knocked out. This is Jose Canseco getting punched out. He's got to be late 50s, right?
He was mad at Dave Portnoy because Dave Portnoy said it was a sad fight and it was just depressing.
Yeah, that's right.
And then he got mad at Dave Portnoy.
It's so funny all that, you know, Jose Canseco, where he was so good at baseball. Like, it's unbelievable how good he was at baseball. And now he's just a total joke.
The steroids were a hell of a drug, though. I mean, you know.
Yeah, that only gets you so far, though. We won't get into that. But
okay, fine.
The motherfucker could hit.
It does something to your brain, though. After a certain amount of time.
After effects. I got you.
Yeah.
A lot of those baseball players now are crazy. Like, what's the
dementia?
The pitcher guy that he said a bunch of crazy shit.
Sean Rocker?
No. Oh well, poor Sam. No, but no. He played for the Reds. He was there.
Oh, Curt Schilling.
Yeah.
The Phillies pitcher. Red Sox pitcher. Yeah.
Isn't he crazy?
He's just like ultra Trumper and posted a
really?
Picture of he posted a picture of a guy wearing a t-shirt that said journalist noose only some assembly applied or something tree. Ooh. And he got fired. Yeah. Oh, he was like posted a picture of that and like I can get behind this and then he got fired from ESPN
immediately.
Didn't they call him the sheriff? Was he called the sheriff?
Who, Curt Schilling?
Yeah.
No.
Who was called the sheriff?
As a nickname?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I'm sorry.
A mariner.
I know the crime dog.
He's thinking the crime dog.
Fred McGriff. Crime dog was Fred McGriff.
Fred McGriff. Yeah. It was also awesome. Do you remember? Oh. Okay. I'll say this. What a great transition from Sid Bream to him. to Crime Dog.
Oh, my God.
Right? Like, I mean, that's like replacing Diane on Cheers.
Yeah, yeah. Getting a Rebecca. You're right.
I mean, getting a Rebecca. I mean, you're like, well, because I thought Sid Bream, I mean, it has one of the most iconic sliding, they're waving him home, sliding into home or whatever, that sports moment. That might be the most sports moment of my life.
I watch honestly. That video often on YouTube and cry.
Really?
I swear to God.
When I watched it live, it was the most amazing
thing.
Yeah,
I remember. Yes.
It felt like a movie, like, yes. But it was real.
It is my most vivid memory from my childhood watching that game happen live. I could
it's
not
unbelievable
because
both his knees are so bandaged up and all that. You know, his knees are hard. Like, I know.
Yeah, you can see around there just like barely moving.
It was unbelievable.
Now, there's a great story behind that. We're getting real deep here because Barry Bonds was on the Pirates. Barry Bonds is the guy who made the throw home, right?
Yeah.
He was playing left field.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so before that play, Andy Van Slyke was the center fielder for the Pirates. He told this in an interview 20 years later. Before that play, Andy Van Slyke, the center fielder, is in charge of where the positioning happens.
Yeah,
he motioned to Barry Bonds, "Hey, come further towards center field. Right, this is where you need to be positioned for this next hitter." And Barry Bonds basically told him to fuck off. Like,
oh, really?
I'm gonna do what I do. And then if you go watch the video. Barry Bonds had to come around and circle that ball to get around it, to take the throw. If he had been positioned where Andy Van Slyke told him to, he would have hit it dead on. Like he would have thrown him out for sure. Cause there was a reporter after that game in the Pirates clubhouse, he walked over after being in the Braves clubhouse celebrating, and Andy Van Slyke was just sitting naked with his head in his hands, just like, but he didn't know why. Like he was like, oh, he must be sad because he lost or whatever. But no, he was devastated because he told Barry, and Barry Bonds left for the Giants that year, free agency gone.
Wow.
That's some good ass lore. That's some good lore. Yeah.
And then became arguably one of the best players ever. Right. I mean,
yeah, the best hitter ever for sure. So,
but disliked,
greatly
disliked for everything until they found out it was in fact him that created Pitbull.
Thank you, Satoshi.
It was a team effort of him and Lance Armstrong.
All the cheaters got together.
Yeah,
we got to fix the money.
All right, see y'all later.
Matt and Toby.